Welcome to the Shortwave Report for April 11th, 2008. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion recorded from a shortwave radio in Northern California. Listening to shortwave at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio and a schedule of English language broadcast. To help you with this, I'll announce times and frequencies at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's www.outfarpress.com, you can find a schedule for dozens of international broadcasters in English. There you can also listen to the past four shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from China Radio International, Radio Netherlands, Radio Havana, Cuba, and The Voice of Russia. We'll begin with China Radio International. A report on agreements reached at the Bangkok Climate Change Conference, which just concluded. Citizens of Nepal are voting for an assembly to rewrite the country's constitution. A Palestinian negotiator says that Israeli blockade and closures have turned the West Bank into a prison like Gaza. Iran is moving forward with its development of nuclear fuel and power plants. China strongly condemned the disruption of the Olympic torch relays by pro-Tibetan protesters. China responded to the criticism leveled last week by Amnesty International concerning the riots in Tibet. China Radio International.
Days of marathon talks. Negotiators at the climate change talks in Bangkok have agreed on an ambitious agenda for negotiations they hope will lead to an historic global warming pact by 2009 and how to combat climate change after 2012. The Bangkok talks required negotiators to settle contentious issues, including how countries will cut their emissions and rich countries will help the poor adapt to climate change impacts and shift to cleaner energy sources. Delegates said significant disagreements still remained, especially over demands from the United States and Japan for developing countries to accept binding targets as part of a pact to stabilize greenhouse gases in the next 10 to 15 years and cut them in half by 2050. Williams Hare is a Greenpeace delegate.
The agreement was nowhere near as good as we had hoped or as, in fact, as demanded by the science and the huge task ahead of the negotiations, but the best that can be said is it's now slowly beginning to inch forward. We saw a lot of setbacks here, but on the other hand, we saw a work plan agreed for the next year.
The new global warming pact is meant to succeed the first phase of the Kyoto Protocol, which requires 37 industrialized nations to reduce greenhouse gas emissions an average of 5% below 1990 levels by 2012. The United States is the only industrialized nation that has not ratified Kyoto, but it agreed at a conference in Bali in December to negotiate a new agreement by the end of 2009. The United Nations climate chief, Ivo de Boer, was pleased to see the agreement reached.
The work for the next year has been agreed, and that means that with the United States at the table, we have an agreed work program on how to take the Bali Action Plan forward.
More than 1,000 representatives from over 160 countries attended the Bangkok talks. The next session will be held in June in Bonn, Germany.
Nepalese citizens are preparing to vote for an assembly that will rewrite the country's constitution and decide on its political future. European Union election observers have been touring Nepal and meeting with local election officials in the run-up to the historic vote, which will take place on Thursday. The team visited Biratnagar, a city about 400 kilometers east of the capital Kathmandu, on Saturday. That was to review a poll security and other arrangements for the election process. The EU delegation, made up of observers from 22 different EU countries, as well as Norway and Switzerland, is the largest international election observation mission in Nepal. Jan Mulder, the chief EU election observer, says the delegation makes it their point that they will be impartial and neutral.
We are here to observe, not to interfere in the elections. We will report as honestly and objectively as possible. We might be critical, but in the end, we hope to be constructive as well.
The EU observers are expected to give their preliminary assessment of the election at a news conference next Saturday. They are also expected to stay in Nepal for several weeks after the election to observe the ballot counting. The mission will then publish a more comprehensive final report in June. Palestinian negotiator Saeb Erkert says that the Israeli blockade, siege, and closure continues to be hermetic, and the West Bank is turning into one big prison, just like Gaza. The remarks came shortly after Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas met for the first time in over 6 weeks to discuss the peace process. The Palestinian negotiators demand more freedom of movement across the West Bank, while their counterparts insist the Palestinians rein in militants. Mark Regev is an Israeli government spokesman.
Both sides today reiterated commitments made, a commitment to try to reach a historic breakthrough by the end of this year, a historic agreement between the Israelis and the Palestinians on the core issues of the conflict, what two states, Israel and Palestine, living side by side in peace look like.
Earlier, the Israeli Defense Ministry said the defense forces have dismantled another 10 roadblocks in the West Bank, bringing the total to 60 since Israel promised U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice to ease movement restrictions imposed on the Palestinians. However, Erkat has termed Israelis' recent declarations regarding the removal of the roadblocks as nothing more than a PR stunt, saying that there is no apparent change. Iranian government spokesman Gholam Hossein Elham said on Saturday that Iran will continue its nuclear program to generate 20,000 megawatts of nuclear power.
The International Atomic Energy Agency is aware of all Iran's legal nuclear programs. Stopping these activities is not on our agenda, and the progress of our nuclear capabilities will continue until the production of nuclear fuel and the establishment of nuclear power plants are in order to generate 20,000 megawatts of nuclear power.
While Tehran insists its nuclear program is intended only to produce energy, there is growing international concern that it could lead to the development of weapons. Diplomats said on Friday that Iran has assembled hundreds of advanced machines as a possible indication that it aims to speed up uranium enrichment, a process that can produce both fuel for power plants and the core of nuclear warheads. The development seems to reflect Iran's determination to push ahead with its enrichment program despite three sets of UN Security Council sanctions, the most recent imposed last month. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Zheng Yu says China strongly condemns the disruption of the Beijing Olympic torch relay in London and Paris by Tibet independent secessionists. Zheng made the remarks when commenting on the attempts by a handful of Tibetan separatists in London and Paris to disrupt the Beijing Olympic torch relay. She says the Chinese government condemns the deliberate, despicable activities that tarnish the lofty spirit of the Olympics and challenges all people around the world who love the Olympic Games. She said China is convinced that nobody can impede the Olympic spirit and the concept of peace, friendship, and progress, which is represented by the Olympic torch. The China Society for Human Rights Studies Vice Chairman Chen Shichou says the aim of the Amnesty International report issued after the unrest in Lhasa and ahead of the Olympics was to create hurdles for China's peaceful development. Shang Lei, director of the society, which is a non-governmental organization, said the London-based Amnesty International should learn some basic human rights knowledge. She says the March 31st report holds that China cracked down on Tibetan protesters, but in fact, the so-called protesters were criminals that involved assaults, vandalism, looting, and arson. They were human rights destroyers instead of human rights fighters, she said. Luo Yanhua, a professor at the School of International Studies of Beijing University, said human rights development of any country is gradual and not to be imposed by foreign forces. Luo says if some Western rights groups really want to help some countries in improving their human rights situation, they should carefully study what they need and offer some practical help.
Those reports were from China Radio International, heard from 4 p.m. to 5 at 13680, 6 p.m. to 7 at 9580, and from 8 p.m. to 11 at either 9790 or 9560. All the times I'm announcing are for Pacific Daylight Savings Time, so adjust them to your time zone. Hello to the listeners of WHUS in Connecticut and the streamers at Radio for Peace International. On to Radio Netherlands. In the face of many protests against China's treatment of the Tibetan region, a Chinese expert questions whether the protests and possible Olympic boycotts are really justified. The attempt to eliminate global stockpiles of chemical weapons is being held up by Arab Middle East nations. Israel's nuclear weapon stockpile is their justification. Radio Netherlands.
Australia's Prime Minister Kevin Rudd has begun a four-day trip to China with a head-on approach to the situation in Tibet. Speaking in flawless Chinese to students at Beijing University, he referred to significant human rights abuses and stressed that peaceful dialogue was the way to deal with the unrest in Tibet. Mr. Rudd's visit comes amidst increasing international scrutiny of China's human rights record and increasing calls for a boycott of the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games in Beijing in August. The Olympic torch has become a focus of protest as it makes its global relay, with chaos surrounding its parade through London and Paris, and activists in San Francisco hanging banners from the Golden Gate Bridge. Organisers have trimmed the torch's route through the US city to 6 miles, but China expert Stefan Landsberger isn't sure the anti-China stance is justified and told me he doubts whether the protest will achieve anything.
As far as it might concern swaying the Chinese government in caving into the demands that are made in the West, I don't think they will have any results at all. On the contrary, I think more and more Chinese are feeling aggrieved by the way they think China is being mistreated in the West, and in particular, they are very critical of the way the Western media have been reporting events happening in China itself.
You've described in a recent article the Eurocentrics in terms of them wanting China to be more democratic, more like a European model. I mean, are you saying that the West is asking too much of China?
Sometimes I think we want China to be like us today, which is sort of impossible. I think China has taken quite a long time to reach a level of development that may be comparable to the West in the mid-1980s, 1990s maybe. And in the wake of that development, lots of things are changing. And I must say, ever since 1978 until the present, in the past 30 years, things have changed tremendously in China. But we don't see it because we don't look back. We don't compare to what the situation was in 1978 and in 2008 as it is now.
But despite the progress that has been made, surely there is a very fair case with China to say that their human rights is not up to scratch. Their freedom of expression, freedom of the press is not acceptable.
Sure, but then, of course, you get entangled in the discussion that is increasingly waged by the Chinese as well. Are these human rights that we want to see honored in China really the universal human rights as we see it, or is there another set of human rights that may be applicable to non-Western nations?
So we've been seeing a lot of protesting Tibetans in the run-up to the Olympic Games. They're, of course, wanting autonomy. They're wanting more control of their country. Do you think they should be sitting back quietly and letting China have the Olympic glory without interruption?
We know a lot about what Tibet wants, but we somehow are not interested in why China thinks that Tibet is theirs. We never pay any attention to that side of the story, and it might be very interesting to find out where these things do not meet or where they might meet.
So is there anything then that China can do between now and the opening ceremony that will convince the rest of the world that they are going in the right direction, on the right line?
I don't think so, because what I think the rest of the world wants to see is that Tibet is liberated tomorrow, or that the Chinese withdraw from Tibet tomorrow and that all political prisoners are released. And I don't think that's going to happen.
And when the protests around the flame have been so magnanimous as they have been in the West, I mean, what do you think is gained by such a public outcry?
I think the Chinese will say, well, it's obvious that the West doesn't understand us and they misbehave. They are very discourteous to us. They are not treating us as the way we should be treated.
Stefan Landsberger is a China expert at Leiden and Amsterdam University.
The agency responsible for implementing the International Chemical Weapons Convention has reported that steady progress is being made to eliminate global stockpiles of chemical weapons and the means to produce them. So far, 183 countries have ratified the convention, but a dozen countries have yet to join the treaty. The report was issued by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, or OPCW, on the eve of a major conference that begins in The Hague here in the Netherlands today. Earlier, Newsline's Alex Tobin asked Radio Netherlands security editor Hans de Vree what stumbling blocks were holding up universal compliance.
I think the basic problem is the Middle East. Most Arab nations have declared on the record that they would not give up their right to possess chemical weapons as long as Israel didn't give up its nuclear weapons, which have never officially been declared, but which everybody presumes it has. The Arab countries have said repeatedly that chemical weapons were the only way to ensure a certain strategic balance in the Middle East against these Israeli nuclear weapons. And that basically is still the point of view today.
And how feasible do you think it is that the remaining countries, the Middle Eastern countries, will sign up at this conference? Will progress be made?
Well, the Director General of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, which is the body based in The Hague that oversees the compliance with the treaty, has said late last week that both Iraq and Lebanon are expected to join the Chemical Weapons Convention during this review conference, this session. But in a strategic context, neither Lebanon or Iraq pose a major problem. The confrontation in the Middle East basically is between Israel, Syria, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Iran, you name it. Although Iran is a party to the convention, Syria is not, neither is Egypt. As far as Syria is concerned, it's presumed as almost absolutely certain that they do have a massive stock of chemical weapons and the means to deliver them, basically rockets and missiles. For Egypt, the picture is a bit more vague, but some people it's safe to presume that Egypt has them too.
How strong is the actual obligation after signing up here to live up to this treaty?
The Chemical Weapons Convention is unique in the sense that it's the only existing treaty in the world, or arms control treaty in the world, that not only prohibits a certain class of weapons of mass destruction, but also provides for all thinkable and unthinkable measures to prevent anyone from producing them. For instance, worldwide, the chemical industry is under scrutiny of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. There are challenge inspections. If there are doubts, the industry has to provide all details of chemicals with a certain dual use. In other words, chemicals that have a application in the civilian, in the normal world, but which can also be used either as a chemical weapon or as a key precursor to a chemical warfare agent. Inspections are obligatory. You cannot opt out. Then you would have to leave the treaty, which nobody wants to do, of course. And the main problem now is to destroy the huge stocks that are left over from the Cold War. And it has proven in practice that it's far more costly to destroy chemical weapons than it is to make them.
Hans de Vries speaking to Alex Tobin earlier.
That report was from Radio Netherlands. Netherlands is heard from 5 p.m. to 7 at 9845 and from 9 p.m. to 10 at 6165. The shortwave report may be downloaded as a podcast by going to www.radioforall.net. On to Radio Havana, Cuba. Richard Falk, a Jewish American law professor, has compared Israeli treatment of Palestinians to the Nazi regime. His appointment to the United Nations Human Rights Commission has infuriated Israel. India and Africa have declared that there is an urgent need to reform international financial structures. Sharp increases in food prices have provoked violence and increased suffering in many developing nations. Radio Havana, Cuba.
Professor Richard Falk, recently named as the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Palestine, has stood by comments likening Israel's treatment of Palestinians to the treatment of Jewish people in Nazi Germany. Professor Falk made the remarks last summer when he said that he did not think it was an irresponsible overstatement to associate the treatment of Palestinians with the criminalized Nazi record of collective atrocity. Speaking to the BBC on Tuesday, the Jewish American international law expert said he would not take back the comments, as he believed that up to now, Israel had been successful in avoiding the criticism that it was due, adding that he understood that it was a provocative thing to say, but at the time he had wanted to shake the American public from its torpor. On March 28 this year, the UN Human Rights Council chose a number of new special rapporteurs on issues ranging from modern-day slavery to indigenous rights. Professor Falk's naming met with sharp criticism from Israel, whose representative to the Human Rights Council, Yitzhak Levanon, said the mandate of the special rapporteur post was hopelessly unbalanced. He added that Professor Falk's views could not possibly be considered independent, impartial, or objective. Africa and India declared there is an urgent need to reform international financial structures on Wednesday at the close of the first Indo-African summit in New Delhi. The world's large financial organizations like the World Bank and the IMF particularly need to change to reflect a shifting global economic climate, said African and Indian officials in the Delhi Declaration. Developing nations must be given more of a voice, they said, through active participation and voting rights in organizations like the World Bank. The declaration was signed by the presidents of Congo, Ghana, Kenya, Senegal, South Africa, Tanzania, and Uganda, as well as the prime ministers of Burkina Faso, Ethiopia, and India, and the Nigerian and Zambian vice presidents. Ministerial delegations from Algeria and Egypt also attended the meeting, as did the African Union leader Alpha Umar Konaré. The summit discussed a range of issues facing India and the African continent and aimed to find new ways for the two regions to collaborate, boosting South-South cooperation. The Secretary General of the UN, Ban Ki-moon, expressed his concern on Tuesday over the increase in food prices, which has already provoked serious outbreaks of violence in many developing nations. In the declaration handed to the press by a UN spokesperson, Ban urges the international community to take urgent measures to guarantee food security in the world, prioritizing humanitarian needs. The top UN official pointed out that the price hikes on food are not only due to the production of biofuel, but also the high prices of oil, which has increased the costs of production and transportation. Ban also added the serious effects of drought and other natural disasters due to climate change. The UN Secretary General recalled that the World Food Programme will assist 73 million people this year, for which $5 billion additional dollars will be needed to cover the costs derived by price hikes. Only in the last 2 weeks, the price of rice has increased 50%. A combination of explosive factors have shot food prices up the world over in the last 9 months, inflicting serious outbreaks of violence in Haiti, Mozambique, Senegal, and Indonesia, among other countries, according to the World Food Programme. According to the WFP's executive director, Josette Sheeran, the social tensions that we are witnessing in Haiti are what we are also seeing in other parts of the world. The increase of prices means less food and more hunger, stressed Sheeran in a report issued at the UN in New York. In her opinion, a new facet of hunger is emerging because even in those places where food is available, there are more and more people that cannot afford to pay such high prices.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba, heard from 4 p.m. to 5 at 9550 and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6180, 6000, or 9550. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or would like to make a donation for production costs of this unfunded program, I may be reached through the website or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. We'll conclude with the voice of Russia. The Guardian UK reports that a secret draft agreement between the U.S. and Iraqi governments will authorize an open-ended presence of troops in Iraq. A commentary on how the American media has returned to stereotyping Russia as it did during the Cold War. The voice of Russia.
A confidential draft agreement covering the future of U.S. forces in Iraq, which has just been passed to the Guardian newspaper in London, shows that provision is being made for an open-ended military presence in the country. The draft strategic framework agreement between the US and Iraqi governments, dated March 7th and marked secret and sensitive, authorizes the US to conduct military operations in Iraq and to detain individuals when necessary for imperative reasons of security without time limit. The authorization is described as temporary, but the document makes no mention whatsoever of any time limit, numerical or other restrictions on the U.S. and other coalition forces deployed in Iraq. Plans like this are normally hatched behind closed doors in Washington, while the broad public is being fed stories about a planned reduction of coalition forces in the Gulf area. just like the reports the top U.S. military commander in Iraq, David Petraeus, and U.S. ambassador in Baghdad, Ryan Crocker, are going to present to Congress today concerning the possible withdrawal of up to 5 army brigades from Iraq before the end of July. There will hardly be any more pullouts anytime soon, though. In Moscow, Vagif Gusenov of the Institute of Strategic Assessments and Analysis says all these withdrawal plans are dictated by political considerations in the walk-up to the November presidential elections. The upcoming elections in the United States are adding a whole new dimension to what the Americans are doing in Iraq. Democratic presidential frontrunners, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, promised that if elected, they would bring the American troops back home fast. Judging by recent opinion polls, these promises are fully consonant with the opinion of an overwhelming majority of Americans, and this is something the Bush administration simply can't ignore, meaning that all this talk about a partial U.S. withdrawal from Iraq is just a last-ditch Republican attempt to turn the table on the Democratic rivals, nothing more. That was a comment by Evgeny Krishkin.
The American news media shut out any good news from Russia. This announcement was made by the Russian ambassador to the United Nations, Vitaly Churkin. Our political observer, Viktor Yanukeyev, writes the following in comment. A silent rule in force in the United States and in a number of other Western nations prescribes to the news media that reports on Russia should be with negative information or with no information at all. Vitaly Churkin had been waiting for 2 years before he saw a report carrying positive information about Russia. The New York Times front page carried an article with a photograph which gave a truthful story of the restoration of peace and stability in the Republic of Chechnya in the North Caucasus. The deficit of true and unbiased information on Russia dates back to Soviet times. The old generation remembers only too well the Soviet day caricature depicting a ferociously looking bear dressed in an overflap with a hammer and sickle and a quilted jacket shaking an axe in the direction of the United States and the rest of the civilized world. However, similar caricatures are frequent in the U.S. press nowadays. As a result, people living, as they think, in the cradle of democracy have a distorted image of Russia and would truly believe a story which says bears walk at random through big cities in Russia and that Russians wear best shoes. This freedom of expression deprives people of the truth about Russia and inflicts irreparable damage on international relations. The stereotype persisting in the minds of ordinary people and politicians is that Russia is a black hole where they drink vodka from early morning till late at night, and during the intervals, if there are any, they steal, rob, and kill. Tourists arriving in Moscow are surprised to discover that they can walk around the streets until late in the evening, and that Moscow is as safe as London, Paris, Rome, or Berlin. Pay a visit and you'll see it for yourselves, writes our political observer, Viktor Yanukeyev.
Those reports were from the Voice of Russia. The Voice of Russia has changed its frequencies. Russia is now heard from 6 p.m. to 10 at 13775, 13635, 9860, and 9665. All the times I've announced are for Pacific Daylight Savings Time. Please adjust them to your time zone. There's an updated frequency guide at the website for this show. The best shortwave frequency guide is available online at www.primetimeshortwave.com. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people to listen to international broadcasts using a shortwave radio at home. It's far simpler than you might think. If you use the internet, listening globally is also quite easy. See the links at this program's website. Every Friday morning, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's www.outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find internet links for international broadcasters, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report is free to rebroadcast upon notification. The Shortwave Report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.